WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
What does it take to save a language? I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. How did Chicago get its name? Chicago. Well, first we have to look to the native people who lived here. The most common well-known meaning of Chicago is wild onion. This comes from the abundance of wild leeks that grew along the river and gave off a strong onion or garlic-like smell. And it comes from the Miamia Taweni language, spoken by the Miamia or Miami, Illinois natives. This language hasn't been spoken for over 50 years. That is until recently. We sat down with two community members, George Strack and Brad Kasberg, about what it's meant to connect to their culture through learning a language that has long been asleep, now awakened. We also talked with Paul Dailing, a journalist who uncovered this story for the Chicago Reader. I wanted to start by getting to know George and Brad more. Here they are.
Ika.
Go ahead.
Tepewanelane. Aya. Wapangia Wainswane. Hi, my name is Brad Kasberg. Nila Miamia Mitosenia. I'm a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma.
Aya. Tepewanelane. Cha Cha Wainswane. And I am a citizen of Miami Tribe, Oklahoma. Cha-Cha is my name. It's sort of a variation of the word George that was
Interesting. And George, you're from Chicago. You also spent some time growing up in Indiana. Is that right?
I spent my summers in Indiana.
Okay.
On a cousin's farm with nine boys. But I didn't realize that it was Miami land, that I was actually had my, you know, walk, as there's a saying that goes around, I'm walking on the footprints of my ancestors. I didn't know that at that time.
So when did that become apparent to you? Much later?
As a young adult, there was more interest in tribal knowledge and genealogy.
Yeah,
I realized that you know, through claims periods, that was all Miami Reserve.
There's a rich history there. Yeah. Well, Brad, when did you start learning your language?
I started at Miami University, named after our tribe, in southwest Ohio. There's a program there focused on language and cultural revitalization. And through that, really, I was able to do a deep dive into our community's language and history.
Mm. Well, let's bring you in here, Paul. I'm curious what drew you into the story.
It's sort of a roundabout story, but I'll tell it quickly. Researching a book on sort of a political history of murder in Chicago.
Mm, okay.
And so I was starting to look into, you know, stuff before 1812 and restorative justice practices and tribal conceptions of, you know, of crime, punishment, and what, you know, to repeat myself just now on national radio because I'm great like that, what became sort of these restorative justice practices that are starting to see light today. And I started getting interested in the language of it and just the amount of culture that's reflected in a single word. Like going back to murder, there's a different Chinese word for murder and murder of a superior officer. And, you know, just in English, the language that's encoded everything, you know, it sounds weird to say the assassination of Dimebag Darrell from Pantera as opposed to murder, but no one would blink at saying the assassination of John Lennon.
Mm.
So just in language, the amount of information like a different word can use. And so I started looking for someone to sort of walked me through this, and I came across the Miamia Center. And then I started talking to more linguists and talking for this larger research project. Mm. And then I just realized this is a really amazing story on its own.
So why did people stop speaking this language?
Well, I think Brad and George can probably speak to this better, but I think that, I mean, it's not that it was a language that people just lost interest in. There were decades and decades of government policy intent on eradicating these ties and intent on assimilation. And this isn't, you know, a secret, but it's just sort of, this is not something that, I know we're not, you know, we're not using words like died because it's not a dead language.
Yeah.
It's a sleeping language. But this is not a language that people just decided to, you know, lose interest in. This was something that was very intentionally eradicated by decades of government policy.
Yeah. George, why don't you pick up on that? I love the idea that we work around saying that it's simply sleeping, right? And waiting to be awakened. So how does a language go to sleep, so to speak?
Well, let me speak about my family, I guess. You know, I'm fairly certain that my grandfather spoke Miamia Twangi.
Okay.
Because his mother did. But largely the removal policies, we were at a forced removal from Indiana in 1846 to Kansas. And then that land was allotted, and we were forcibly removed to Oklahoma. And that sort of separation from your land, mm-hmm. your homeland, is really integral to maintaining culture and language. And that removal and separation and being in communities where your population is in decline and the amount of, you know, just ordinary commerce interacting with the communities, you know, they had to learn English. And when they got to Oklahoma, the community was a very small group of a remnant of the tribe that ended up in Oklahoma. And I think for the same reason, they were there with multiple other tribes that English eventually became the lingua franca for the community itself. And we're thinking that by the 1960s, there were still a few speakers left, and we don't really know that they were really in conversation with each other per se. But certainly by the early 1900s, the language was in full-blown decline and had gone to sleep.
Yeah, as I mentioned, up until recently, I mean, the language hadn't been spoken in more than 50 years, so that checks out with what you're saying there, George. Brad, where do you even begin to revive a language that can feel lost?
It's complicated.
to say the least.
We're lucky enough that we had outside linguists who had been studying the language originally pretty academically, just as sort of a understanding of grammar, syntax, structure, all of that. Mm-hmm. But connecting with our community, we realized that it needed, that there was room, that it was asleep, that there were people ready to wake it up. And so it was collaboration, as I mentioned earlier, with the university that really really turned this into an active practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to be honest, it's difficult to do because
how so?
where do you begin, right? It's language is part of your everyday life, and you're trying to be one or maybe two or three people in a household revitalizing language where there's not necessarily people around you speaking it or anything like it.
That's
really
a lot on your shoulders.
Yeah, it's a lot to really kind of make it a part of your day to day. You have to be really, really just proactive with it.
Yeah, even that collaboration piece you just mentioned. I mean, do you get together and practice? If so, what's that like?
So you know, well, we're lucky. Group texts.
Really
carry our water here. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I also during the pandemic when we couldn't travel to Oklahoma. Because that's such an important time for us to sort of all merge together and speak the language together. Over the pandemic, I started hosting a Dungeons and Dragons theme, a Miamia themed campaign with some of my relatives.
Nice.
So that's been a way to really just commit ourselves to mm-hmm. holding space and just speaking as much as we can together.
To that end, Paul, I mean, you mentioned in your story in the Chicago Reader how the, quote, switch from academia to activism was tricky. Can you speak more about this and the challenges there?
Yeah. I think one thing I got, because also for the story, I interviewed several non-native linguists working for the Meow Meow Center. And also just there's a wide variety of academic literature out there about some of this, articles on JSTOR and stuff. Just the sensitivity of someone who is trained to teach something, learn something in a college setting as just sort of this airy academic thing to study, an artifact for study. And then you have, and then you're working with people who, this is their culture. This is the, one of the most poetic phrases I came across, and this is actually the name of some institute or something, they can correct me on it, but the breath of life. And I just really like, and it's just,
you're getting nods.
Yeah,
you're correct.
Okay, good. And it's just the idea that language is an academic thing, that you can talk about morphemes and polysynthetic languages and all these other terms that I had to spell check 8 to 10 times to make sure I was getting right. And then just talking to some people like Brad and George and Kathy, who's also in the story, about just what it means. Kathy, who's also in the story but wasn't here today, talked about actually weeping the first time she heard the language spoken. She didn't understand the words. She's only recently started studying it. But just hearing something, knowing that it was something her grandfather had heard as a child, just she wept. And so it's just, I found it very interesting, the article, talking to people who were talking about morphemes.
Yeah.
And technical terms, linguistic terms, and then just the act of weeping just from the act of hearing.
Did either of you, Brad and George, have a similar emotional reaction when all started to sort of come to light?
Yeah, I mean, I can say the first traditional story that I heard was told by George. And I remember not getting it. And I remember it was mostly in English, but just really trying to really learn and expose myself to a whole new world that was, you know, opening up for me. Mm-hmm. So it was unbelievable.
It's overwhelming, it sounds like. I mean, and George, I mean, it's one thing for a person to learn their heritage language, so whether it's Spanish or Arabic, Italian, whatever it is. For most people, that's just an individual choice, right? But for you all, it seems like the stakes are so much higher, because you're not just like learning this for you, but you're learning this for your people, or to keep the future of this language alive. That's such a huge responsibility to take on.
Oh, yeah. And there is a strong emotional component to it. My grandkids all call me Mesha, which is how they refer to me as the grandfather. Mm-hmm. I have not used either my sister's names or my son's names in years. We use nothing but kinship terminology, which, from my mind, that reinforces that identity and that connection that we have. But again, even in the community when no language was really being spoken and the program had just commenced, that it was a broad acceptance and support from the whole community that they knew this was important to us as a people and our identity. And to watch the Meow Meow Center grow. And I remember a summer program when I was down there with Brad and three other guys after a youth program at end. And I was just standing there in amazement because they'd all learned Meow Meow together at the university. And they were all joking and just having a great time together. And I was just like, this is really amazing that you've got
to hear them just speaking it.
And humor, to bring humor back in a language is so important.
You know, it's also this is also a reminder that the crimes committed against Indigenous peoples, including forced assimilation, they aren't just of the past, right? These are things that are still very much present today. How do you come to terms with that as you do this work, Brad?
Yeah, it's ever present. You really can't avoid that conversation in any native media, you know, whether it's books, TV shows, anything, because it's front and center for us every day, the remnants of it, but there's still lingering acts of it. Just the idea that native people can't be in Chicago, right? Just that idea alone is something we constantly have to work against. So it's difficult, and it's just part and parcel with the recognition that being who we are is a verb. It's not a passive
yes.
thing.
Very important.
WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
Perhaps the most mind-blowing part of reading Paul's story was the fact that you all are not just speaking this language today, you're also adding new vocabulary. What? So, you know, words like cell phone, bicycle. I mean, how do you create new words?
I text people that do it, and then they eventually come up with it.
That is that group chat again.
Yes, it is a critical group chat for the community. I'm not going to lie. Language and the words we use are there's an underlying structure to them and a purpose, no matter what language that is. And there's a cultural viewpoint of creating words. I think a funny example in English is walkie-talkie.
I'm already laughing.
Yeah, that's
because how are you going to translate that?
So, I don't have the translation for walkie-talkie, but what I mean to say is that the patterns of speech, for example, lemonade. I remember walking through that with folks. We knew the word for tea, mishapakwapoe. We knew water was nipe. But we needed something for lemonade. And so we needed a word for lemon, which did not exist in our homelands centuries ago. And so yellow fruit drink is what we decided on. And
how do you say it?
Unzawa minapoe.
Unzawa minapoe.
Yep.
That's lemonade.
That is.
Right? George, tell us more. I mean, and I want to hear more about that humor that you've heard sort of injected in here.
I found it interesting because these were the four young men at that point, you know, after a youth camp, you know, had all gone through the program at Miami University, and they had to take they have a heritage program, so they were able to go to school, but they had to attend a requirement class for six semesters, and part of it was language. But I think they just hooked up as friends, and I think that was important, is that as young guys do, they joke and tease. And I was just amazed by that and that kind of thing. But, and again, I think Brad brought it up, we have the mechanism. We understand the linguistic formula for creating new words, and it is a group process. It's nothing that anybody does together. But just watching that program evolve from Daryl Baldwin, who started as a grad student, as an adult returning student at the University of Montana, and I remember coming back in summers, and he would sort of teach us on a broken chalkboard down in Peru, Indiana, just the rudiments of what he was learning, and how with his connecting with David Costa, who was our primary linguist, and the two of them looking back at all these documents. And first of all, they were in Old French, so they had to have somebody could translate Old French.
That's right.
Which is this amazing process, the formula they put together to just translate, you know, these at least 30,000 odd words or more, and bring it back into a modern orthography and for people to learn, and then to create programs where you can actually get and you can go on your phone and listen to an audio file. So if I don't know how to pronounce it exactly, I'll click on the audio file.
There's always an app or something that can help. Paul, I mean, your mind must have been blown doing the research for this.
It absolutely was.
Just seeing this level of collaboration.
Level of collaboration, just the mixture of the humor and the emotional resonance. You know, I'm talking to people who are weeping upon hearing a language. Mm-hmm. And then the translation, my favorite, you were speaking about the humor a second ago. My favorite translation of one of the newer words was for cell phone, which, if I'm getting this correct, uses the morphemes for little thing one talks into all the time. And I'm like, that is a much better word than whatever cellular refers to.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, no, it was a really amazing process. And the Miami Center has just such amazing resources. They put me in touch with native speakers. They actually got in touch with this through Brad wrote an article for Belt Magazine about his Dungeons and Dragons games. I reached out to him through that. But just amazing place, amazing resources. They, one moment I'm talking to David Costa about this archaeological treasure hunt that found the oldest French Miami-Atawengi dictionary in the Jesuit archives in Canada, and none of them knew what was there, because it was one among a ton of books about Ojibwe.
Mm-hmm.
And the next moment I'm talking with people about like hearing it for the first time and the emotional resonance of it. And then I'm, you know, getting these amazing, then I'm hearing about finding new swear words. That's in the article. I don't know if that's clear to
that's
say
for
on
another
the air.
Hour.
Yeah.
it
was just an amazing story, and just the Miami Center was just so great in putting me in touch with people and helping me walk through this very technical story in a way that it hopefully is still readable.
It's a great story. Brad, what do you want people to know about Chicago, Miami, and how? Or maybe hope that people remember about Native American Chicagoans.
Yeah, so the city of Chicago has one of the largest Native populations of any major urban center. So that alone is something folks should recognize. But in general, you know, I think it's about just understanding our history and our places. And our place names, and really understanding that there's a long connection that people have and still maintain with it.
Yeah. George, you talked about, you know, your grandkids, hearing them speak and call you, you know, native names. I mean, why is it important to you that people see this language as something that still exists today? It's not just something of the past.
Well, I think that's a, you know, it goes across the country. I think Native communities, you see revitalization happening across the country. And, you know, and I think about, well, why is that happening now? And why is that so important? And I think that it all comes down to belonging, ultimately. We all need, as human beings, to belong to something. And to have that common heritage that's, resides through a language and through places. I mean, when you think about Chicago and the area that surrounds us and the amount of Native names for places where people live, people don't even realize what those names are. You know, Waukegan and Kankakee and Milwaukee, Kenosha. You know, so these are all Native names that people don't even realize the connection to that deep history. And I think it's important for both from a historical perspective, but also as a living community. There's a saying goes, we are not a people of the past, we are people with the past. And to see our community grow, and languages is an integral part of that. We are community meetings in Oklahoma, languages, you know, always a part of that. And to see people gather and play traditional games and it does bring, you know, something very strong emotional component to all of us. To
very
see
special.
That,
yeah. We've been speaking with journalist Paul Dehling and Miami, Illinois speakers Brad Kasberg and George Strack. Thank you all so much. What a great conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Ari Mejia, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Max Lubers. Reset brings you the local news you need to know. So don't forget to tune in tomorrow and subscribe to the podcast so that you never miss another conversation. You can also check out our full archive of conversations at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you so much for listening.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.